We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Focus. Good morning. I'm Bill Hammack. Today I'm looking at the events of the 20th century through a very interesting lens, a set of 264 miniature figurines. My guest today wrote the book The Hare with Amber Eyes, A Family Century of Art and Loss. It's a story of how his family history is interlaced with these figurines, but more than being a mere signpost to their story, he meditates on how objects get handled, used, and handed on. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area or anywhere else in North America. Call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Also, keep in mind that you can listen to WILL live online, and if you like, send me a question via email at WILL-talk@illinois.com. Let's welcome to Focus Edmund Duvall.
Hello.
Hello. So, Edmund, as I noted in the introduction, this is a family history centered on an object or a set of objects. But to set the stage, I want you to first look at the heart of the story, the figurines, and then we'll look at the beginning and the end, and we'll spend the rest of the time fleshing out and filling in the story. So first, what is this object or these objects? What exactly are these 264 miniature figurines? Not how they were acquired, but just what are they?
Well, it's a very good question. They are very small Japanese toggles called netsuke, and they were made between the 18th and 19th centuries, and they're made of ivory and bone and boxwood, and they were toggles to hang off your kimono, the belt of your kimono, and they are extraordinarily beautiful little depictions of animals and people, craftsmen, lovers, mythical creatures. All kinds of subjects are considered, and they are beautiful little sculptures to finger and have in your hands.
Mm-hmm. And so they're made of wood and ivory. And how big did you say they were? What's the dimension?
Well, they're very, very small. That's the marvelous thing about them, is that they're maybe in a couple of inches at the most, mm-hmm, in size. Mm-hmm. And they really, you know, half the size of a grown-up's thumb. Perhaps that's the best way of describing it. Very, very small. Mm-hmm. And some of them are very intricately carved, and some of them are very sort of gesturally and liquidly carved. They're all very, very different, but they are extraordinary little objects.
So now let's look then, just very briefly, at who acquired them in your family? How did they get started in your family?
Well, it's quite a history, but the very beginning of the story is Paris, because they were collected by my great uncle, to make it simple, who was a collector in Paris in the 1870s. It was a Jewish family. They'd come originally from Odessa, and they were ludicrously rich.
How did they get so rich? What was the source?
They had cornered the market in grain. They'd become the biggest grain merchants in the world. And they tried to do like the Rothschild family did. They sent their children out to Paris and to Vienna to set up their empire, you know, in Europe, and to marry the right girls and to set up their companies and their banks. And the story starts, I guess, with the collector of these little objects, who was the third son of this great dynastic Jewish family, who was a man called Charles Efrussi. The family is called Efrussi. And Charles, was a young man with lots and lots of money and a new, rather beautiful house in Paris, which was completely empty. And so he starts collecting.
Mm-hmm. So he was a third son. Did that give him, take away some responsibilities? Did it leave him free to do some of these things?
Yeah. The third son is key. I mean, this is partly, I guess, to be honest, because I'm a third son, so I've got a great deal of time for third sons. But the oldest son was, you know, like all good kind of 19th century dynasties, the oldest son goes into the bank and becomes, mm-hmm, the financier and head of the family. The second son goes off and becomes a jeweler and a rather famous lover of women, according to the gossip columns in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps turning up in extraordinary scrapes in Paris. And the third son, Charles, is an art lover. He absolutely adores art, and he has no family responsibilities. And so what does he do? He starts buying things,
mm-hmm.
and rather wonderful things at that.
So let me first of all remind our listeners that I aired on our email address. It's willl-talk@illinois.edu. Apparently I made the University of Corporation a few minutes ago, so we'll get a question started that way. So you were saying this is the third son. He had time to collect these. There was a certain craze at that time. What was that craze called, and how did these fit into that craze in 19th century Paris?
Well, the craze was Japanism. The craze was for all things Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles, it moves in a circle of artists. His friends are poets and his friends are painters. And, you know, he was a friend of Monet and Manet and Degas and Renoir. I mean, extraordinary people to have as your friends. And he buys mm-hmm. all their paintings. He mm-hmm. has... His room has 40 extraordinary Impressionist paintings. It really is quite an incredible collection. Beautiful, beautiful paintings, most of which, I have to say, are now in American museums.
Mm-hmm.
but all these artists and all these poets were completely entranced by the new things that were coming in from Japan. Japan had just been opened up by Commodore Perry, and there was a flood of things into Paris, lacquers and ivories and famously woodblock prints. Mm-hmm. So all these artists are sort of competitively, greedily collecting these things. And so amongst his friends, he did what everyone else was doing. He bought Japanese art, and he bought 264 of these little beautiful netsuke.
Hmm. And did this Japanese craze, did it eventually... lead the way to things like Art Nouveau and Cubism?
It's one of those wonderful catalytic moments of sort of where one kind of art meets a completely different alien way of looking at the world.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this sort of sense when you look at the paintings of that moment that people are just entranced by this way that the Japanese had of looking at details in different ways, or looking at texture in different ways, or sort of blocking color in different ways. And so it does transform. It really transforms painting. And we would have no Monet cathedrals or haystacks, or we wouldn't have a lot of Degas or Manet without Japanese art. So then it leads on to lots of other things, but it's a extraordinary moment in Western art, and it all happens in Paris.
And so these are things like maybe a lack of perspective in shadow or flat areas of strong color. Was there compositional differences too?
Yes, compositional. So what you get is you don't get the sense of sort of perspective that is the norm in Western paintings. So you get things cut around. That the you get things in the foreground which are huge and things in the background which are hardly there at all the other way around. So you get a completely different sense of storytelling, I suppose, in pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not just in painting. It also happens, of course, in the decorative arts. So all the things that come from Japan also feel completely exciting, and the lacquers and the textiles, and indeed the ivories. And all these things are doing new things, and that's why all these artists get so riveted by them and start collecting.
And is there evidence that Charles loved these netsuke, or was it just one of many things that he collected? Did he leave any writings or comments about them?
Not about his netsuke, unfortunately, but he did collect, and had with his lover, he collected an amazing collection of Japanese lacquer, a famous collection of Japanese lacquer, which he did write about beautifully. And mm-hmm. when he describes the Japanese lacquer and how the Japanese artists had toiled over this lacquer, he also goes on to talk about Impressionism. He makes these connections between these new objects that he adores and the new art in it, which he was living and breathing and writing about. So they are absolutely joined together in at this strange moment in Paris.
Mm-hmm. So early in the book, you make the point that you don't want this to be the rather standard story, and I don't want to trivialize it, but standard story of a wealthy European family's decline through the trials and tribulations of two world wars. Instead, here's what you write. You said you want to be here with Anetsky. I want to know what the object has been between this wood. I want to know what the relationship has been between this wooden object that I'm rolling between my fingers, hard, tricky in Japanese, and where it's been. I want to walk into each room where this object has been. So let's start walking through those rooms. You mentioned Charles. Let's add a little texture to him. Apparently, he was the model for one of the Proust characters in the great multi-volume In Search of Lost Time. Which character was this, and how was he a model for it?
Well, unsurprisingly, he knows Proust. Charles knows Proust. In fact, Proust is a sort of secretary for him. And Charles Swann...
So did you just say that Proust was kind of a secretary for him?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. I mean, it's a pretty good story, this. Because, you know, my Charles, the guy I grew to absolutely love as I walked through his rooms and walked around Paris and walked into all the different places he'd been, is the model for Charles Swann in Search of Lost Time. Charles Swann is the protagonist and is the great collector and lover at the heart of the novel. The narrator really learns from Charles. And there's a sense that I got very excited by, I guess, in the book and in the research, which is that, you know, Charles and Proust were great friends. And what happens in Proust's novels is that all Charles's paintings turn up in the novel. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. Absolute descriptions of every single one of Charles's paintings are there in the book. And
is that right?
It's extraordinary. And in fact, I was talking last night at the Phillips Collection in Washington,
yes,
where there's the great Renoir of the boating party, that wonderful picture of a famous picture at the Phillips Collection. And there in the very back of the Renoir is Charles with his top hat on in the boating party. That's Charles. And there he is in Proust. Proust talks about that very picture. He says, there at the very back of a painting on a summer Sunday afternoon is the patron of artists.
So
all interleaves.
So Charles was friends with Renoir also.
He was not only a friend of Renoir, he was a patron of his. And not only bought pictures by him, but commissioned all his... He got all his friends, and indeed his lover, to get Renoir to paint portraits. My journey through the archives, I kept coming across these... there's nothing quite as ghastly as a French archive. I don't know if you've ever spent any time in French archives. They are absolutely the grimmest places in the world. And I was in the archives of the Louvre, which are particularly prison-like, and came across these wonderful letters between Impressionist painters and Charles. And I was laughing out loud, and this terrifying French woman came to tell me off. But how could you not laugh when you find these extraordinary funny letters between these artists and this young, well-off, amiable, interesting man? I got severely told off.
So, I've read In Search of Lost Time and read a little bit about it. One who reads that book can't help but read about it because it's very complex. I don't recall seeing this connection. Is this something new in your book, or is this just well-known and generally known by Proust scholars?
It's known by Proust scholars.
Okay.
It's known by Proust scholars. And I'm quite careful, I think, because what I really didn't want to write was another bit of cultural history. I didn't want to write a book which is art history. This is my family story, and it's a kind of autobiography through these objects, and a kind of story of my family through these objects. And so, you know, there aren't any footnotes. You know, I'm not wearing my academic hat here at all. And actually, it's written as my journey through the archives and through the paintings and through the places.
Well, you mentioned a moment ago walking in Paris to where Charles was.
Yes.
For all of the locations here, and we'll get to them as we go through the interview, did you actually visit all of these and take them in?
I did. My shtick here is that this is a non-Google book. You know, I wasn't going to sit in London you know, with Google images in front of me and just try and patch it together through, you know, digital way. I'm an artist. I make things.
Mm-hmm.
It was absolutely imperative to me that if I was going to do justice to the story and do justice to the objects, to the feel of the objects, I absolutely wanted to go and be there. And so I kept going back to Paris and, you know, walking between Charles's apartment and his office and the studios and just getting into the rooms that he'd been in, getting into the archives and feeling the texture of the newspapers and the journals and the letters. Because to me, it's about touch as much as, you know, you can't tell the story without being truly involved in it as a sort of walking person.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take up that thread a little bit. First of all, though, this is Bill Hammack, and I'm visiting with Edmund Duvall. We're discussing his engaging memoir, The Hair with Amber Eyes, the story of his family's century-long engagement with a set of 264 miniature figurines called Netsuki. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area. Anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455. 800-222-9455, or use email will-talk@illinois.edu. So, you know, you just mentioned being there, and I note that in the book you have this this sentence: how objects get handled, used, and handed on is not just a mildly interesting question for me, you write, it is my question. Why are you being so emphatic here? What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, Phil, I mean, thank you. That's a really, that's a difficult, good question to ask. The reason it's my question is that for really all my life, I've been a potter. I mean, I was apprenticed when I was very young, and I make objects. And how objects work, how objects are handled and thought about and used and moved around in the world, and how people place them, and how they buy them and pass them on and give them away, all those questions are things that I've had to deal with as a maker of objects.
Mm-hmm.
It's increasingly, as I've had more and more exhibitions and worked in museums, and it's become something that I really am sure now that's my thing. That's the center of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I inherited this collection of these hundreds of objects, How could I not take their physical reality seriously? That is my story. That's absolutely the alpha and omega of the story is their objecthood, what they are like, and how they get moved around the world.
Well, a wonderful aspect of this book is that it really is about the nature of touch almost. And how is a potter does that, you know, refine your sense of touch? How does that influence what I see on the page, which is very visceral?
Well, I mean, the thing is that I was okay. There's a positive and a negative there. The positive thing was I was absolutely determined that, because I don't think people talk about touch nearly enough.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be really evangelical here, Bill. I think that
that's fine.
It's one of the senses that is simply not thought through and talked about and cared about enough. I mean. And so the fact that, you know, how something works in your hand, how if it's balanced, if it feels warm, I mean, how quickly it's been made or slowly it's been made, how three-dimensional it is, how much presence in the world it has or absence in the world it has, are things that, of course, as a maker of objects, I care about. I mean, how could I not? I've spent all my time doing these things. That's the positive bit. The negative bit is I was absolutely sure that, in fact, at one point, the whole book was going to be called A Secret History of Touch, but my publishers got cold feet and called it off. But the negative thing is that I felt absolutely sure that that these kinds of objects hadn't been written about properly. And so there was a feeling, I was at the barricades for this, because I really wanted to write properly about touch and how one object can mean one thing in a, you know, beautiful Paris salon with this great collector handing it round to his impressionist friends, and can mean something completely different 30 years later somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Which is the, you know, the signpost that you use throughout this. And so Let's move those objects along then a little bit. We have Charles who purchased them. He was a model for Swan in Proust in Search of Lost Time. Where did they move from Charles then? Whom did they go to?
Well, this really is extraordinary. They were given as a wedding present to my great-grandfather and great-grandmother. Mm-hmm. They were the Viennese side of the family. If you remember right at the beginning, I said that some of the family were sent to Paris and some were sent to Vienna. Well, mm-hmm. this is where the story sort of forks. Mm-hmm. He sent them as a wedding present to my great-grandparents who lived in the Palais Effrosi in Vienna. It's a ludicrously enormous mansion on the Ringstrasse. It was built in the 1870s opposite the university, just along from the opera. Mm-hmm. Five stories of gold pilasters and turrets, a vast mansion, a palace. And it was sent as their wedding present. So it arrives in 1899 and is installed because they didn't really know what to do with it. My great-grandparents, it doesn't really fit in this ludicrously stuffed house. It ends up in my great-grandmother's dressing room, looking out onto the Ringstrasse.
Mm-hmm.
That's the second place it gets to, from Paris to Vienna.
And what propelled it out of Paris? Was there a political movement? Or
what propelled it out was that Charles really, he was a collector and a man of taste, and he'd really fallen out of luck. The Japanese objects were no longer the thing to have. He now collected French furniture and French tapestries and Gustave Moreau paintings. He'd had an even bigger house in Paris. And so these little Japanese bibelots, these little Japanese objects, no longer fitted. And so a very generous present, but also a pragmatic present, he gave them away, and he gave them away to his favorite cousin, my great-grandfather. And so they arrive with a vitrine, mm-hmm. as a kind of ludicrous, fin de siècle present.
So
you really make it up, could you?
No. So you mentioned 1899, and what that prompted to me is that was the Dreyfus affair and the height and away of French anti-Semitism. Was that a factor here?
Well, I'm convinced that when I looked at the descriptions of Charles's new house in Paris, and you know, which is he decorates in a completely French way. You know, nothing which isn't French is in that house. And then I read all the kind of blistering anti-Semitic reports about the family and about Charles and about his brothers. You know, because they were prominent Jews, they were absolutely in the eye of the Dreyfus storm. I'm convinced that Charles is trying to make himself even more French than he normally, you know, he's trying to assimilate into French society. And that's also in Proust, of course, when you read it. You know, mm-hmm. Dreyfus Affair is this cataclysm in Proust's novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But anti-Semitism in Paris is horrific. It takes on a completely different turn, of course, as I guess we'll get to in Vienna.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's move to Vienna. It's turn of the century Vienna, 1899, 1900, as you said, and the family was Jewish, as we just noted. What was life like for Jews in that time?
Well, it's extraordinary because Vienna has a bigger proportion of Jews than anywhere else apart from, I think it's Budapest and New York. It's extraordinary.
At that time, right?
At that time, sorry. Yeah, and, yeah, it, okay. And you know, the Jewish run newspapers, opera, music, literature, journalism, politics, and money are predominantly Jewish in this town. Mm-hmm. So there's this extraordinary sense of Jewish culture, this efflorescence, this flowering of Jewish culture. And, of course, there is this vicious, absolutely vicious, sort of rolling anti-Semitic undercurrent the whole time, undercurrent and then overcurrent. I mean, it becomes palpable, it becomes visible as well, you know, with anti-Semitic demonstrations and tracts as well being published. But, you know, I stood outside this big family house, this ridiculous family mm-hmm. house, and mm-hmm. I thought, you know, there they are. That's pretty self-confident. This is not a house that's been built for wandering Jews. This is some staking a claim for Jewishness and for for visibility in the middle of Viennese life. And that's what being an affluent Jewish family in turn of the century Vienna was like. It was very different if you came from the shtetls. It was very, very different if you've escaped from a Russian pogrom and are a peddler and have come into Vienna with nothing on your back. Very different Vienna. But for the affluent, you were part of society.
Mm-hmm. And does that house you said still exists? What is it used for now?
It's now Casinos Austria.
Well, what is that? Casinos? Gambling?
It's offices.
Oh, offices. All right.
So I mean, when I went back, and I walked into this courtyard, this five-story courtyard in the middle of the house, and said to the person at the desk, this is my family house. They looked absolutely appalled, I have to say, that I'd come back. But then they took me around. They were very generous, and they took me around, and they showed me the salons and the ballrooms and everything else, marble staircases and these completely crazy ceilings with biblical figures on them. And, you can't move for putty and gold and marble.
Hmm.
Pretty gross, actually, in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we've moved the objects then from Paris in the late 18th century, or 19th century rather. We're in Vienna now. It's 1900, 1910 or so. Let's look at those objects. I assume they're in some special place where no one can touch them or do anything with them, and they're just viewed. Is that correct?
No. It's better than that because the Netscape and their vitrine, their big glass case, are placed in my great-grandmother's dressing room. And she was a great beauty, and she had lots of lovers, and she was endlessly dressing up to go out to balls and events and things. And her dressing room was the only place that her children, her three children at that time, were allowed to see their mother. They were allowed to come in and see their mother, Emmy, as she was dressed to go off. And at that point, they were allowed that hour when she was dressing, being dressed by her maid, Anna. That was the moment they were allowed to go and see her, and that was the moment that the vitrine was opened and they were allowed to play with these Netscape. So they become toys again. They become little objects that they play around with. And my grandmother and my great-uncle, who I knew very, very well indeed, used to talk about sitting on a golden carpet in their dressing room, talking to their mother, who was being sewn up into some amazing fantasy-like dress, and getting out their favorite Netscape and talking about them and playing and arranging them. And so they've become toys again. They become objects of love and devotion for children.
Mm-hmm. So this is your grandmother playing with the Netscape.
Yes.
And one of the joys of this book is that we meet these fascinating people. Can you just tell us about your grandmother? What made her remarkable?
Well, I was very fond of my grandmother. She was she grew up in this extraordinary conventional house, but she used to look out of her window across at the university, which is just across the Ringstrasse, this great road around Vienna.
Yes,
and she was determined to get an education, and she was determined to study at university, and she did. She was one of the few young women and Jewish women who actually managed to get to university, and she became a lawyer, but the first woman lawyer in Austria. But even more remarkably than that was the fact that she was passionate about poetry. And when she was still a teenager, she sent her poems to the great, great poet, my favorite poet, Rilke, Rainer Maria Rilke, who is a wonderful, wonderful poet. And he writes back. He and Rilke have an extraordinary correspondence. Rilke critiques her poems, and she writes devotional letters to him, and then he sends back his latest book with an apology for it having taken so long, but he's only just finished this sonnet sequence. And they have this extraordinary correspondence, which is unpublished, this Letters to a Young Poet, Volume 2. They are really wonderful poems.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's a woman of a real woman of substance. She has guts, she has rigor, and she obviously is someone who ultimately, over her very long life, also becomes the center of the family in a really important way. and I was very devoted to them, so as you can probably tell, Bill.
So your grandmother becomes the center of the family, but at the time, the period we're talking about, a major world event is World War One that occurs.
Yes.
Did that affect the Netsky and affect the family fortunes?
Well, didn't affect the Netsky because the family, the house, it remains completely intact throughout the First World War. But the Austrians, of course, are on the losing side, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire is eviscerated. I mean, it just
disappears.
Disappears completely.
Rapidly. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So that there's nothing left but this tiny little country called Austria with this great imperial city stranded in the middle of it. What happens to the family is that my dear great-grandfather, Baron Victor von Uffizi, is possibly the worst businessman of all time. He has the family bank. He refuses to get any of his money out of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And loses his Russian fortune to the Bolsheviks. Well, that's not his fault. The Russian Revolution takes away that. Because he's on the losing side, his French and English fortunes get taken by the French and English government. And he's been a massive supporter of the Austro-Hungarian government by buying war bonds. And then there is this thing called inflation. So vast amounts of their fortune by 1919. They are by no means penniless. They are still remarkably wealthy, but they're not the plutocrats that they used to be. And writing about that was extraordinary because I kept finding I spent a ludicrous amount of time in different archives, and I spent some time in the bank of all things, the bank archives in Germany, and find all these descriptions of bankers saying, "Well, you know, that we could probably just about save the bank." Very strange moments in these little bits of marginalia in bank archives, which sound as dry as anything. But anyway, I bring them alive.
You really do in this book. I mean, it's an incredibly, incredibly rich book. This is Focus, and I'm Bill Hammack. I'm talking with Edmund Duvall. We're discussing his thoughtful memoir, The Hare with Amber Eyes, A Family Century of Art and Loss. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL or anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455, 800-222-9455, or use email, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Well, I just bumped the title there. It's the Hare with Amber Eyes. Is there one of these that is a hare with amber eyes?
There is. And I suppose that's an object which sort of stands for the whole collection. It's a very beautiful little ivory Netsky with amber eyes. And that's just one out of these hundreds that I particularly love. And so that stands in for the whole collection.
So in our chronology, the Netsky, the figurines, are now in Vienna. It's about 1938. I assume Hitler invades. The family's fortune is disrupted. In fact, what happens to the family? And then what happens to the figurines?
Well, 1938, when Hitler invades, it is cataclysmic. I mean, they are the very night that the tanks roll across the border, you know, the front door of their apartment in the palace is broken into. And the family are assaulted, and, you know, a hugely beautiful bit of French furniture is picked up and thrown down into the courtyard. And they're looted. And that's the first, these are by neighbors. You know, this is the night when the next morning when the elderly Jewish neighbors are on the streets, scrubbing the streets of Vienna. It's an extraordinary, horrific moment, this flowering of anti-Semitism in Vienna. And my great-grandfather is arrested, and he's forced to dig a ditch. You know, he's 75, he's forced to dig a ditch in central Vienna with a placard around his neck. And a week later, the Gestapo arrive, and they basically start choosing what they want. The family are dispossessed. The Gestapo choose which paintings are going where, what's to go to Hitler, which bits of furniture go to museums, which Nazi functionaries should have what things. And the bank is obviously Aryanized. It's taken over. They have only what can go into a suitcase. And my great-grandmother and great-grandfather escape across the border into Czechoslovakia, where my great-grandmother commits suicide. Eventually, after great travails, my great-grandfather finally arrives in exile into Britain. Mm-hmm. And they have left behind this house, this life, relatives, and this whole place which they have brought their family up in for 80 years. And one of the many things they've left behind is that vitrine with Netscape in it. You know, one of the many, many things that's left behind in this looted house.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens to them, of course, is the kind of crux of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Bill. Should I tell the next
one? Sure. Oh, yes. I would love to know.
Okay,
so we got your family out. They've lost, apparently, their fortune. It's about 1938. They have gone to England. Your great-grandmother, who was the second to receive these, committed suicide. And Linetsky apparently were left behind in Vienna and maybe lost forever. But tell us what happened.
Well, what is absolutely extraordinary is that my grandmother, in 1945, goes back to Vienna. And Vienna, of course, is in ruins, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
It's been liberated by both the Russians and the Americans, and also belatedly by the English. And she goes back to the family house, which is now occupied by cheerful American army. and she goes up there, and there's, you know, a couple of pictures on the walls and a couple of bits of furniture that the Nazis couldn't move. And the very nice American lieutenant, takes her around and says, well, I don't know, there's nothing really here for you, but there's an old lady who's still here. She might be able to tell you what happened. And the old lady turns out to be her mother's maid, my great-grandmother's maid, Anna, who had been a maid in the house, looked after my great-grandmother, brought up the children. And Anna had amazingly, during this great looting of the house by the Gestapo, she had put the Netske one by one in her apron pocket, and she'd taken them to her bedroom, and she'd sewn them into her mattress.
Hmm.
And she had rescued the Netske. She said to my grandmother Elizabeth, she said, I couldn't rescue, you know, pictures. I couldn't rescue Fabergé's objects from the mantelpieces. I couldn't rescue jewelry, but I took what I thought was most important. And she deliberately rescued the Netske, and she'd put them in her mattress, and she'd kept them there. And so in 1945, my grandmother meets Anna, and Anna says, I've got something to give back to you, and she gives back these extraordinary collection of Netske. It's the only thing that actually survived. I can't tell the story without feeling the kind of Bill, it's still an extraordinary moment of transition. It really is extraordinary.
Do you think she partly saved them because the children played with them, or
it's about knowing what's important, and she knew that the most important thing were those hours between Emmy and the children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an act of love. I mean, it's an act of madness to try and get, you know, to take things away from under the noses of the Gestapo. I mean, how crazy is that? But it's an act of real, you know, an act of thinking about love, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the act of, and then giving it back to my grandmother, saying, well, these are yours. I kept them for you. I mean, it is an extraordinary moment.
So your grandmother gets them back. It's about 1945. Yeah. They have another couple of years in Vienna, and then they end up in an area or a part of the world where I never thought they would end up. So who gets them next?
Well, the story keeps on going, because my grandmother took them back to England in a little attaché case, and my great uncle Ignace was visiting England after the war. He'd fought in the American army.
So Iggy is the brother of your grandmother.
Yeah, Iggy is the brother of my grandmother.
Right. And he's one of these two little kids that played with these. They're Emmy's children, and they played with him during that hour when they met with her.
Exactly. He played them sort of in early Vienna, and he'd run away to America just before the war to be a fashion designer. And to do all the things he couldn't do in Vienna. He was gay, and he wanted to be a fashion designer, and he ran away. But when the war was declared, he signed up and fought his way across Europe, like so many did. And in 1947, he's demobbed, and he goes to England to see his sister.
So which side did he fight on? The German?
The Americans. He was General Patton?
Patton. General Patton.
Yep. Mm-hmm. General Patton's interpreter. From Normandy onwards. I mean, he was part of all that. Mm-hmm. And when he was demobbed, you know, he didn't really know what to do, and he went to see his sister.
And first of all, he's not wealthy at this point, right? The family has lost their fortune.
Mm-hmm. The family are absolutely on their uppers. They really are. But he goes to see his sister in England, and his sister Elizabeth says, well, you know what? The only thing we've got are these. And she produces this attaché case of Netscape. And Iggy says, well, I know what I'll do with those. I'll take them home. So he decides to go to Japan. He decides to take this collection to Japan. It's completely crazy. It's another completely extraordinary moment in the story.
And so at that point, is he immigrating to Japan or just visiting Japan?
Well, he has an opportunity to go and work in Japan. It's during the American occupation. There's a need for business people to go. And he decides that he might as well go to Japan. He looks at these objects. He doesn't know what to do with his life. He's 40 years old. Mm-hmm. He has no particular attachment anywhere in the world. He's a Jewish, dispossessed, demobbed, ex-Viennese, ex-American soldier. What's he going to do with his life? Mm-hmm. Well, he gets given, you know, he looks at the Netsuke and says, well, I'll go to Japan. And that's what he does. 47, he goes to Japan and he gets a job in Japan as a businessman in occupied Japan. And he builds a house for the Netsuke. He builds a vitrine for the Netsuke. And the Netsuke are back in Japan. It is quite extraordinary. There are wonderful photographs of him in the 50s in this house he builds in Tokyo, which he shares with his Japanese partner, Jiro. Mm-hmm. And their parties full of Japanese people, full of Americans, full of conversation, with this great vitrine open in the back of these photographs and all these people picking them up, handing them around, talking about them, enjoying them. The Netsuke have, you know, a third place to be.
So let's look at his relationship to those, because as we said, the book is a lot about touch and it's about the meaning of these objects. It's about viewing them, you know, and seeing them rather than pictures. What was he? Was this his last remaining thread to his childhood, to his former life before he became an exile?
Yes, yes. I mean, that's why they have this. In many ways, part of the book, Bill, is trying to work out about objects and memory. I mean, we all know how powerful that is in some way in our life. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, a cup from a grandmother, or, you know, a photograph of a relative, or a book that's been given to us, or something. There's something in our life which has some kind of embodied memory, some kind of memory of things that have happened elsewhere. And one of the strangest things for me was, because I went to Japan when I was really quite young and saw these objects in this glass case in his study, and he would pick them up and he would talk about them, and he would say, these are the things that I loved when I was a child, these are the things that I played with when I was a boy. And then stories would start unfolding, you know. You know how it is with the elderly, that at a certain point they, you know, people start sharing their stories. And often the things that unlocks the storytelling is a picture or a photograph or a taste. You know, when someone drinks some tisane or eats some borscht or something, and then something starts unraveling.
This is very Proustian, is it not?
Well, I'm sorry, I'm being over Proustian here.
But that's exactly what it is. It's fascinating. Yeah.
And so, you know, part of what I'm, my attempt with this book was really to look at why objects matter in people's lives, and what we and how you can tell the stories that are there. Mm-hmm. The stories that sort of hover around them, you know, the stories that sort of collect around the things that matter. Mm-hmm. And these objects for my very dear great uncle were the things that took him right back to dusk in his, you know, being near his mother for the first time, the only time that day, playing with his older sister, looking at clothes and feeling clothes and thinking about fashion and the intimacy of that sort of magic hour with his mother 80 years before.
And was this your first encounter with the objects, or did you know of their existence before you started to
visit them? I didn't know about their existence at all. I didn't know about their existence at all. I knew a lot from my grandmother about Vienna, because she used to tell me a lot, partly because we shared a great passion for poetry, and she kind of took it upon herself to educate me in poetry and make sure that I had a proper education, not just a one from school, about poetry. But from Iggy, that's in Japan. That's where I find the Netsuke, and that's at that moment in his life. It's where he starts talking about them, and so it's a very very moving part of my life. The hours that I spent with this lovely elderly man in Tokyo.
So we have a call. I want to go to a call on line 4 from Effingham. Effingham, please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I would like to interject into this conversation historical factors and the Hebrew peoples and how that has been played out over the last 2,000 years. First the Diaspora in 70 A.D., and then the reestablishment of the Jewish state in 1947, I think it is, and the aftermath of that, and how, you know, if I'm to understand or to recognize the migrations into Egypt, you know, there some long time ago, and how that played out. But it seems to me that the cohesion of Judaism and how that has affected the world and how it is affecting it now and how is it going to play out in these times? Can you answer any of that?
All right, caller. To note, by the way, it was 1948 when Israel was founded. Did any of this family end up in Israel?
No, they didn't.
Okay.
They didn't. None of the family are in Israel, but I think the core of your caller, the caller's question, is this question about diasporas, about movement of people. And of course, when I look at my family, I see a diasporic family. I see a family that has, you know, was in England and Mexico and America and the UK. I see the children of all living different lives in different places, but still being part of the same family. And of course, part of what I try and do is to talk about how objects are diasporic, how objects move around the world as well.
They're diasporic, but they're also a touchstone and a fixed point at the same time.
Yeah,
it's a paradox, isn't it?
It could not be more paradoxical. Mm-hmm. It could, you know. And the challenge of talking about how objects can stay together and how objects can be talked about in the memory of objects, and also about a diasporic family, was very difficult for me. I mean, I've spent many years reflecting on how I could try and tell this particular story. But yes, the diasporas are at the heart of the book.
So I probably need to finish the story of those objects or bring it up to date before the end of our interview. Your uncle Iggy, as you call him, you had a 20-year relationship with him. You visited him in Tokyo, learned about the objects, and then he died in 1993.
Yes.
And what did he do then with the objects?
Well, he passed them on to me, and I am the fifth generation of the family to inherit this extraordinary collection in 140 years. And so they're now with me in London, and I have three children, and I have put them in a vitrine in our sitting room, and they are played with by my children.
So your children are allowed to touch them and pick them up and play with them?
Why would they not be able to play with them? I mean, the whole thing for me is that actually objects come alive. Uh-huh. Objects come alive when you move them around.
Do you think your children appreciate yet what those objects mean? Have you tried to explain to them, or you just let them have their own relationship to them?
I think it'd be ghastly if I kept telling them that they're really special. I mean, that would kill them dead. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nothing worse than being told by, particularly by a parent, A, you know, be careful with this object, it's really special, or worse even, be careful with this, this is an inheritance or this is an heirloom. I mean, how appalling is that? This is an anti-heirloom book. It's a tract mm-hmm. about handling things and letting them live in the world with some latitude. So I was asked last night, people said to me, well, what happens to them next? To which my answer, of course, is I have no idea. That's mm-hmm. my children's story. It's not my story. It's not my problem. They will get passed on to the children. What they do with them is up to them.
Edmund, that's a great point to end. So thank you for taking the time to
chat. Thank you so much, Bill. I really enjoyed it.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Edmund Duvall, author of the memoir The Hair with Amber Eyes, A Family Century of Art and Loss. Technical director for this segment was Jason Croft, and the producer was Harriet Williamson. We'll have more Focus coming up in a few minutes, but first we'll break for a market update and news from National Public Radio.